Good morning, everyone. The story of my testimony in Allianz, rather incredible. It's like a movie script directed by God, the great ending you would expect from such a screenwriter. However, I'm not sure anyone would believe it. If Midge, my wife of 29 years, and I had not experienced it, I'm not sure I would believe it either. But the experience, our experience, is a good example of the Lord working in your life even when you don't recognize it. Now, I would not be a believer of you living in Israel if not for my wife, Midge, the Lord's instrument in changing my life. Many of you know Midge, and since she is a central figure in my story, the rest of you should know her as well. Midge, would you stand up? First, a bit about my background. I was born in New York City 82 years ago, that's right, 82, to secular Jewish parents. My father would go to the local synagogue on High Holy Days of Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, but otherwise, we were Jewish only because we ate bagels and lox and matzah on occasion. There was a Siddur, which is a prayer book in our house, but I don't remember ever seeing a Bible. And I think this is typical of many secular Jewish people in the United States. Everyone has a Siddur, but in my experience, very few have a Bible. The only exception to this secularism was on Passover, when we went to my paternal grandmother's house and had a Passover Seder. So I knew the Exodus story, but Passover was the only Jewish holiday I knew anything about. You know, when I heard of others like Hanukkah or Shavuot, I always thought they were all about Egypt. And I wondered why the Jews kept going back there to such an awful place. Now looking back now, it seems like nothing has changed. We're still trying to escape from Egypt 4,000 years later. It seems as though there are four constants in the world: God, sin, anti-Semitism, and Egypt. A friend of mine once asked me why Jews have been so hated for thousands of years. I answered that it's because we gave the world the Ten Commandments and they've never forgiven us. Now, life was simpler when I was a child in the 1930s, a long time ago, and early 1940s. The radio was a child's communication with the world. Children don't read newspapers, and there was no television, which was 10 years in the future, and certainly no computers, which were 20 years in the future. Unlike today, there were many religion programs on the radio, and I spent many hours with my ear glued to the radio, and I learned the words to lots of the classic Southern Baptist hymns, you know, the old rugged cross and how great thou art, blessed assurance, amazing grace, and all of these kinds of things. To me, they were just beautiful melodies, and I didn't relate them to prayer or thanksgiving at all. Now, Midge and I sometimes go to the Sunday service here, where Pastor Al Micheroni uses the Hallowed Baptist Songbook and the music ministry. And sometimes it seems like my childhood is returning. It's like old home week again, listening to some of these songs. Now, after high school, I did what was expected of a Jewish boy. I went to college, eventually passing through Ohio State University, the University of Texas, and UCLA as an agnostic geologist. I subsequently taught at the University of Houston, University of Oklahoma, and several other places around the world. I married as a student at the University of Texas, but unfortunately, this ended in divorce after 25 years and three wonderful children who at that time were all in college at the University of California. But I enjoyed marriage and wanted to try again. Now, as is normal for a guy interested in getting married, I dated several women during the next few years, but no relationship lasted. Now, in 1984, I was dating a widowed Jewish woman in Oklahoma City, about 30 miles north of Norman, where the University of Oklahoma was and where I lived. Now, my Jewish lady friend was a member of a secular singles group, and one of their activities that year was raising money for the Oklahoma Theater Center in the city. And as part of this effort, they were holding a dance one evening. Members of the group were encouraged to bring friends as guests, and Sandy, my Jewish lady friend, brought me. And as Midge and I always remember, that was April 14, 1984. Now, members of the group were not supposed to stick with anyone they might have brought, but were supposed to mingle and dance with everybody. Well, guess who was a member of the group and was there at the dance? Yes, you're right, it was Midge. Needless to say, she was attractive and well-dressed, much as she is today, and I gravitated to the bench where she was sitting in between the dance numbers. Now, in entering major relationships, since I was looking to get married, everyone has filters, usually unspoken, to screen out those who they don't think are not suitable. I view filters as very important, particularly when searching for a wife. Now, I'm someone who likes to get right to the point, so I asked her my three filter questions. First, do you smoke? No, she didn't, so she passed that one. I couldn't imagine living with a smoker. Second one, do you still have children living at home? No, she didn't. Hers, like mine, were all grown. So she passed that one. And the third filter was, do you like to travel? And she said, who wouldn't like to travel? Well, my unspoken answer was that my first wife did not want to travel. That was the purpose of the question. So she passed my three major filters. I had no way of knowing at the time, but I didn't pass her most important filter. I was not a believer, and she wouldn't marry somebody who wasn't a believer. As I said, people rarely verbalize their filters, and certainly not in the early stage of a relationship. I asked for her phone number, but neither of us had a pen or pencil, and so Mick scrounged around and finally found somebody who had a pen, and so I got her phone number. A few days later, I called her for a date and we set up a time. She was again nicely dressed and told me she bought all her clothes at second-hand stores, where nearly new things cost only a few dollars. Miracle of miracles, she was low maintenance. Always an appealing factor for a prospective husband. For dinner, she would take me to places where the food was free. Clubs where if you ordered a drink, you could eat the food on the counter and over the bar. It was not steak and lobster, but inexpensive stuff like pasta. But it was fine as a stomach filler. Neither of us cares about booze, and so we would order Cokes or ginger ales, something like that, and have a free dinner. She didn't wear jewelry and told me she thought diamonds were a waste of money. I thought I died and gone to husband's wedding. Here I had an attractive woman who didn't buy new clothes, knew where to get free food, and didn't buy jewelry. Women like that are hard to come by. I had never read the Bible, and she suggested I read it. So I did, which took a while. It was not easy reading for me. Some of the books, like Exodus, seemed like they would never end. I felt like I could have walked across the Red Sea myself in the time it took the writer to tell the story. But I eventually finished not only Exodus, but everything through Revelation. I found the prophecies about Jesus in the Old Testament, written hundreds of years before his birth, and the evidence is about his life, death, and resurrection in the New Testament to be convincing. Either it was all fiction, what we would today call a novel, or it was a reasonable recitation of what actually happened. I concluded it had happened. And continuing with the interaction between Luigi and me, having hooked me with her looks and personality characteristics, she did the biblically prescribed thing and took me to church every weekend. I had never been in a church before. She wanted to be sure I understood what was important to her and why we could never marry. However, she miscalculated. It was April, and the first service we went to was an Easter pageant that I found glorious. The church was large with many hundreds of parishioners and had what I could only describe as a large music ministry group worthy of Radio City Music Hall in New York. I enjoyed it very much. I ignored the sermon, but overall the service was interesting and enjoyable. On subsequent Sundays, I started paying more attention to the message from the podium. The pastor's name was Richard Hogue, and he was a spellbinding speaker, clear, logical, and convincing. The Bible came alive in his presentations. He was indeed a gifted preacher. One Sunday, there was an altar call, and I went forward and made a commitment to Jesus. It was an incredible transformation from my viewpoint only a few weeks earlier. A few weeks later, I wrote a letter to my family describing my new views. No one replied. Midge and I continued to see each other, but had many differences of opinion about some biblical things, to the point where she could not imagine that we could have a long-standing relationship. But again, she was mistaken. The Lord had other ideas, and so although she had serious doubts, God convinced her in various ways that she was to marry me. We were married 5 months after we met, on September 11th, which is my birthday. She chose that day because she thought it would help me to remember our anniversary. Being born on 9/11 turned out to have its advantages. Now the whole world talks about my birthday. Now, for our honeymoon in 1974, Midge wanted to go to Israel, which we did over Christmas break at the university. When we were there, we did the normal tourist things, visiting the Old City, Dead Sea, Masada, Qumran, the Galilee, and so on. We enjoyed our visit, but had no burning desire to return. It was one of those been there, done that things. The important thing on the trip was that I was baptized in the Jordan River. I don't recommend doing this in December because of the freezing water. Surely the Lord would be just as happy with someone doing it in the summer. In 1987, we went to a Holy Spirit conference in New Orleans. It was a meeting of spirit-filled believers from all the denominations, Catholic, Protestant, and Jewish. During the day, people could go to the meetings of their religious group, and everyone gathered together in the evening to hear a well-known speaker. Midge had gone to a similar spirit-filled meeting before in Kansas City in 1977, but had attended only the meetings for Catholic believers. This time, we went to the Jewish gatherings. One of the speakers was David Stern, a name whom many of you may recognize as the author of the Jewish New Testament, the Complete Jewish Bible, and other books about Messianic Judaism. In part of his talk, he said that Jews need not ask God whether they should live in Israel. The Bible says in many places that that's where Jews should be living. You can ask when the time is right for you to go, but not if you should go. I thought that this was this guy's opinion and was not binding on us. Midge wanted to know whether this was God's opinion and not just David. Then Midge read two books, one by Tom Hess called Let My People Go, the other by J. Rawlings, called Fishers and Hunters. They were filled with Bible quotes telling Jews to live in Israel. Midge told me that if I wanted to move to Israel, she would go. But she said we needed to go soon, before the Jews were forced to leave the United States in droves, as the Bible says they will someday, and before the American government limited the amount of money an emigrant could leave the country with. We knew some countries had imposed such financial restrictions. She wanted us to leave soon so we could find a nice place to live. She feared that if we waited, we might have to live in a tent, and she was not into living in a tent. It's too hard to decorate. But she said that God didn't tell Catholics to go, only Jews, so the choice was mine. I said she had nothing to worry about, as I would never live in Israel. I would soon get a lesson in never saying never. Never say never. When we got married, we were both broke. I had three girls in college, owed money to my mother, and owed money to my former wife for her half of the house. She didn't want the house, and so I bought half of it from her. And both Midge and I had mortgage homes. Then blessings started to roll in, and we were able to pay off all our debts and even start saving. About the time we got married in 1984, an executive from Petrobras, the Brazilian National Oil Company, came to my geology department to speak. While he was there, he asked me if I'd be willing to come to Brazil for 6 weeks to give an advanced course to a select group of the company's petroleum geologists. The group would be chosen by competitive examination among the company's geologists. All had to be fluent in English since I don't speak Portuguese. I gave the course 4 or 5 times to different groups of the company's geologists. Midge and I were flown business class to Rio. Back then, food was served on long flights, and the meals on Varig, the Brazilian national airline, were extraordinary. Fancy menus with many choices of items to choose from. There was one strange thing, however. The smoking section was on one side of the plane, and the non-smoking section on the other side. Not a front and back division the way it was on American planes. It seemed to us Varig was missing the point of the non-smoking section. From Rio, a taxi took us to Ouro Preto, a mining college in the mountains north of Rio, where the class was held. For 6 weeks, I taught students while Midge read, resting in the hammock in the best hotel in town. We both had a wonderful time. Also, about the same time in 1984, I received a letter from the University of Würzburg in West Germany asking me to give a course there. They knew me because I had been there 10 years earlier on a Fulbright scholarship. It seems that many of their faculty were of the World War II vintage and were all retiring, and they were short-handed. Right? So for several years, Midge and I commuted between Oklahoma, Brazil, and West Germany. It was a wonderful and financially beneficial era in our lives. In 1993, I was supervising a student from Egypt who was working on his PhD. My arrangement with the government of Egypt was that when he finished, they would fly me to Egypt for a few days to examine the rocks that the student was studying. I was on sabbatical leave, and it was Christmas vacation at the university. Midge suggested we use the trip to Egypt to visit Israel for a month. I said, what can we do in Israel for a month? Little did I know what the Lord had in store for me. My plane ticket was free, and thanks to Brazil and West Germany, we had enough frequent flyer miles for Midge to join me. So we flew to Tel Aviv, and a few days later I flew to Cairo, did my professional work, and returned to Israel. We stayed at St. George's Guest House in the Arab section of Jerusalem, which at that time was run by Brits. An Israeli friend told me that by staying in that area of Jerusalem, we were making a political statement. I told him I wasn't making a political statement. I was making a financial statement. It was the cheapest place we could find. I later realized that in Israel, everything is interpreted politically. We wanted to visit some Messianic congregations in Jerusalem and had been told in the States by Bob Lindsay, who was the founder of Baptist House, and another miracle lived in Norman, that we should meet a very bright guy in Jerusalem named Joe Shulam. Joe was and still is the leader of Nativia, a Messianic congregation located only a block from here. We were welcomed there by everyone and even went on a bus trip with them. After one of the services, David Stern, the president of person we have heard speak at the Holy Conference in New Orleans in 1987, and who attended Joe's congregation, invited Midge and me to his house for coffee and cake. While we were there, David, as he always did back then, asked me whether I had considered making Aliyah. I replied that it wasn't for me. After a while, we got up to leave, but just then, Shira Sokaram invited to visit Martha, David's wife. Shira and husband Ari lead a congregation in Tel Aviv. We told her we got their newsletter regularly in the States, and would visit their congregation if we got to Tel Aviv. So we sat down again to talk with her. Shira, like David, asked me whether I had considered making Aliyah, quoting Deuteronomy 30, one of the many passages that tells Jews to live in Israel. For the first time, I didn't quickly answer no, and it suddenly seemed to me to be the thing to do. I didn't hear any voice. It was simply a miraculous change in viewpoint, equal to my committing to Jesus 9 years before in Richard Hope's church. It's impossible to predict what the Lord will do in your life. David pulled out a street map of Jerusalem and showed us the location of the Mizrach HaKinim, where we had to go to file immigration papers. It was Wednesday, and he said we had to go the next day, Thursday, because after that it was the weekend, and the Mizrach was closed. And we had to be there at 7:30 a.m. because when they opened, because the line would be long if we got there later. So we were there at 7:30, and I spoke to the woman at the desk. She asked whether I had joined another religion, and I said no. She asked why I wanted to live in Israel, and I answered because I'm Jewish. Because we came to Israel as tourists, I had no evidence that I was Jewish, and so later that day, I had to contact my mother for proof. She sent her ketubah, which is a marriage contract with my deceased father, along with a letter from an Orthodox rabbi. My mother, being secular, didn't know any Orthodox rabbis who might write a supporting letter, but had a friend who did. My mother visited with him, and he wrote a letter in Hebrew for her. I subsequently asked an Israeli friend what it said, and he told me it said that she was my mother and I was not a bastard. Now that was nice to know. I took the ketubah and the letter to the Mizrach, and they told me not to return for 30 days to get our two zachzahus. They would not mail it. I had to come in person. Now back then, the non-Jewish member of the family got a tudah at the same time as the Jewish member did. Now I understand it's a lot more involved than that, but that's the way it was then. Having to come back in 30 days posed a problem. We had already been gone from the States for 2 weeks. We had returned tickets, plane tickets, for 2 weeks in the future, but we needed to stay for 30 days, not 14. So I wired my university department that I would not be back when the spring semester started and to begin classes without me. They had no way to reach me, so all they could do was to be upset. We called our realtor in the States and told her to put our new house up for sale. It was a model home that we had bought only a few months before, and we thought it would sell quickly. It did not, which was a blessing that we did not immediately realize, as you will see shortly. When Midge and I left the Mizrach, we looked at each other, and one of us, who really don't remember which one of us, said, "Let's buy a house and take in people." And we both thought it was what we should do. Another miraculous event. We had no idea how to do this and didn't know anyone who did. Certainly, we didn't know anyone in the States who ran such an operation. Since we had to stay in Israel an extra 2 weeks at least, we needed to find a place to stay that was even cheaper than St. George's Guest House. We didn't know how long we'd need to stay because friends told us that the Mizrach told everyone 30 days, but it was never ready in only 30 days. Back then, in 1993, the Baptist house had a bookstore with a large bulletin board. The bookstore no longer exists, obviously. We saw an ad for a room to rent from a woman named Hila Brand, now known as Hila Crown Tamir, who was still a good friend of ours. At that time, she was a student in tour guide school and is now a very accomplished tour guide. We went to her apartment and rented the room. The next day, Hila had a visitor named Carol Herrick. Carol had written a wonderful and incredibly useful book called Shock Absorption. That was a municipal Bible for native English speakers. We carried it everywhere. It was about 150 pages long and told in some detail about life in Israel and listed all the misrads, what they did, their addresses and phone numbers, as well as other things an English speaking immigrant would need to know when arriving in the country. We told Carol that we had just made Aliyah and that we planned to buy a house and take in people. She replied that was her heart as well, and that she would drive us around and show us neighborhoods where people lived. Tourists concentrate on sightseeing, don't think about where people live. And she put us in contact with a believer realtor named Imunah Gorman, who is still a good friend of ours. So on Sunday, only 3 days after our Aliyah decision, we were already looking at houses to buy. We wanted to live in Jerusalem, so although we looked in nearby places like Mount Seret, we concentrated on Jerusalem. In 1993, the only large houses we liked or could afford were located in the city in the Gilo neighborhood, and there were several for sale. Within a few days, we found one we thought would fill our needs and agreed on the price with the owner. But he wouldn't sell it to us. He said he didn't even buy a car that quickly and that we should return to the States and he would contact us. We later found out he was in a government lottery for some property and didn't want to sell his house until he knew whether he was a winner in the lottery. So that door was closed. We certainly weren't going to go back to the States and wait for him to call. Then we found another house in Gilo that we liked even better and agreed on a price with the owner. But when we brought the papers to sign, he changed his mind. Another door closed, so we gave up. I might say that the behavior of these two owners is illegal in the United States. In the United States, if you agree on a price with the owner, he has to sell it to you legally. But that isn't the law in Israel. So we gave up. There seemed to be a message here. Apparently, we were not supposed to buy a house during this trip to Israel. When our 30-day Misrad time arrived, I went to the office, and our two dots were ready. How often that happens in exactly 30 days, I don't know, but it happened for us. Another semi-miracle, probably. 2 days later, we returned to the States as citizens of Israel. It turned out that because I had just had a sabbatical leave, I could not retire immediately, but had to remain at the university for another year. So it was a blessing that our house didn't sell. We didn't need it right away for our down payment in Israel, and we still needed it to live in for another year. The Lord knew this, although we didn't. So it was December 1994 before we were able to return to Israel to stay. In the intervening year in Oklahoma, we never had any second thoughts about living in Israel. It was what we both wanted to do and thought only about our lives there. We were totally committed. We flew to Israel on December 14th, the day after classes were at the university. Our realtor, Imunah, arranged for us to stay in Ramat Eshkol at the apartment of Bill Wolford, who worked for the Christian Embassy, who some of you may know. His wife was a singer at the ICEJ Feast. They were going to the U.S. for 3 months, and so we rented their place. When they returned, we stayed at the apartment of Messianic singer Jonathan Sattel in Beit HaKerem, who was going on tour to the States. All the while, we were looking at houses with Imunah. We returned to the first house that we had tried to buy, but this time he wanted $100,000 more than he did the previous year. At the second house we had tried to buy, the owner wanted $200,000 more than he did the year before. So scratch those two. We then revisited the house we had seen the previous year but had not liked. The owner had moved to Ra'anana for business reasons and needed to sell the Gilo house to pay for his Ra'anana house. The price was the same as last year. That evening, Mitch flew back to the States to finish packing, and I signed the papers for the Gilo house on my own. Midge's parting words to me as she left for the airport were, "If you can find someone who will sell us a house, buy it and I'll change it." We had big parties in the States and we'd be doing the same in Israel, as many of you know, and the Gilo house had a large grassy backyard for the purpose. So we now owned a 5-bedroom house, but we didn't have the money for a down payment because our beautiful house in Norman had not yet sold. So to overcome this problem, the owner of the Gilo house and I made a deal in which I would give him a non-refundable 15% of the price immediately, and he would give me until August, 6 months away, to come up with the rest. It was panic time. We had crawled out on a limb and could only hope the Lord would sell our house in the U.S. before August. Midge and I were certain we were following the Lord's instructions, but were not happy with this latest test. So the months passed. February, no sale. March, no sale. April, no sale. May, no sale. June, no sale. Then in July, a realtor in the U.S. called and said we had an offer that was for exactly what we had paid for the house a year and a half earlier. Talk about a last minute reprieve. Bank Leumi then gave us a loan for the rest of the money we needed to pay for the Gilo house. Back then, and perhaps now as well, the bank required 3 co-signers for the loan. But we knew no one other than the members of Joe Shulman's congregation. The first 3 people from the congregation that we asked agreed to sign for us. 2 of them had no money to speak of, but this was not anything the bank cared about. A responsible person was a responsible person as far as they were concerned. It was a human being to sue if we failed to repay the loan. Then as now, before we took possession of the house, we were getting the grapevine newsletter from King of Kings Ministry and saw an ad by someone named Johannes, who was seeking a room for a German friend of his who was arriving shortly to be a student at Israel College of the Bible, which was then here in Jerusalem, but has since moved to Netanya. In my old town at the time, there was a student named Johannes in the row in front of me, and sure enough, that was the Johannes in the grapevine. So he recommended me to his friend, and so we had a renter before we even had a house for him to live in. I then went to Israel College of the Bible, told them about our accommodations, and by the end of the week, we had a full house of Bible college students for our 4 extra bedrooms, 3 young men in their 20s and an older woman. 2 days before we were to take possession of them, Gilo house, the port in Haifa called and said our shipment had arrived and to come and get it. Otherwise, they would start charging us for storage. We didn't have a car, so the next day we took a bus to Haifa to claim our stuff. The next day, we moved from Jonathan Sattel's apartment in Beit HaKerem to Gilo. Note the timing here. I mean, everything happens just when it was supposed to, not a day too late. The day after that, our shipment arrived from Haifa, a 40-foot lift and a 20-foot lift, a monstrous amount of stuff, much of which we had bought at garage sales in the States as preparation for housing guests, extra beds, furniture, cabinets, bedding, and tons of other stuff. The Gilo house was a mess, with boxes and workmen around continuously, tiling floors, renovating the kitchen, etc. And the rooms needed painting. This was done with the help of the students, who also unpacked boxes and carried heavy items. A few days into this mess, Midge asked the students, "Can't you find any place better than this to live?" But eventually, the workmen completed the renovations and left. The rooms got arranged and we all settled in. For the next year and a half, we were filled with students from the college. We only had 1 bedroom unoccupied for 1 day in a year and a half. It was incredible, verifying that we were doing what God wanted us to do. But Midge and I were like lone soldiers. We hardly knew anybody. We had no family here. We needed to meet people and find friends if we were going to be happy in Israel. So Mitch started her Israeli tradition of having big parties with as many as 80 to 100 people, inviting everyone we knew and their friends. The living room, dining room, and backyard were full of people. That's how we became members of the community. The Gilo house was on a hill with 33 stairs from the street to the front door. Midge had trouble with the stairs, but friends told her it was good exercise and that she would get used to it. She never did. And after 12 years of stairs and wanting a smaller house, we sold the house and moved to Malha. Our parties nowadays are restricted to something about 20 people. Now, a few words about what I have been doing during the 19 years we have been here. I write geology textbooks for university students, and when I arrived in Israel, the Institute was using two of my books as a text to two of their courses. So they knew who I was and asked me to do some teaching. So I taught at Hebrew University in Gibeah Ram for 12 years. Although all courses in the university are taught in Hebrew, exceptions were made for Aliyah people for a couple of years until they learned Hebrew, and for guest speakers from around the world. I never became fluent in Hebrew, but the Institute needed my expertise, so I got away with teaching in English for the entire 12 years. Now, all the students and faculty are fluent in English. Not only must a student pass an English exam to graduate from high school, but if he or she doesn't do well enough on the exam, there's another English exam before the student is allowed to enroll at Hebrew University, or they may be required to enroll in an English class at the university. Nearly all the textbooks at Hebrew University are in English, and in the sciences, all are in English. The texts are the same ones used in the US, UK, Australia, and other countries where English is a native language. Try to imagine this in the United States. Lectures from the professor in English, but the textbook is in German or French or Spanish. That's it. You can't imagine that in the US. My students were incredibly good. In my second year course, the questions I got were those I got from graduate students in the United States. On the exams, the same ones I gave at Oklahoma, almost everyone got over 80%. I tried to understand why they are all so smart. I decided there were three reasons. First, Hebrew University is very selective in admissions, unlike state schools in the U.S. where admission requirements are low. Second, the students here are all Jews, and education and health have always been of highest priority in Jewish culture. Third, the students here are older. After high school, the males go to the army for 3 years, 2 years for females. And after the army, they often take a year off to travel, go to the Himalayas in India, or to the US or South America. So when they start college, they're 22 or maybe 23 years old, often married with children. They're very motivated, unlike the 18-year-olds who enter American colleges. The quality of the students is perhaps best illustrated by my experience with a graduate course I taught in my first year here. It was concerned with applications of advanced chemistry to geologic problems. I always had a problem getting students to take the course in Oklahoma because the geology students had considerable trouble understanding the chemistry. And on exams, the grades were usually terrible. When I first gave the course here, there were complaints to the chairman of the department that the course was too easy. It's not hard to understand why Israelis and American Jews win a high percentage of scientific awards and Nobel Prizes. Finally, a word about Midge's current activity. She has recently started a new prayer ministry concerned with prayer for Aliyah from the United States, where we believe the next large Aliyah will originate. The idea is for small home groups of, say, 1 to 5 people to form and meet all over the world. If you have any interest, please let her know and give her your email address so she can mail you the current information. Thank you. I might say Chuck says some of you were interested in environmental things and asked me to bring a couple of my environmental books here, which I have done for any of you that would like to look at them.
I've never ceased to amaze at the unique ways that